Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to tonight's edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to have with me Greg Bishop and Jeff Ritzman, and we're going to tackle a question from one of our Patreons that was really a really good deep question. And I did this with Joshua Cutchin and Rosian, and I forget who else was in on the conversation that time around, but I figured Greg and Jeff needed to address this question and see where it went. So we'll get to that in a minute. There is a new t-shirt design up. You can see it currently on the Facebook page if you want to check that out. Jeff Ritzman did it. It's a very different design than what we had before. The shirts are also cheaper than the ones we were using before. I'm going to be switching over to this service as well because it's probably a good $10 cheaper. We're still not making very much on the shirts, but if you want to support the show, get a shirt. And also, if you want to support the show, become a Patreon. That really helps a lot. I'm thinking of adding another level to the Patreon thing. Right now, there's only the $3 level. You're, of course, welcome to donate more. But I'm coming up with some incentives for higher levels. So hopefully that will happen sometime in the very near future. There is a Patreon-only segment, about a half an hour worth, with Jeff and Greg talking about some of our own personal experiences that have happened recently. And that will be up during the week. But for now, here's this very deep and bizarre conversation with Greg Bishop and Jeff Ritzman. All right, and tonight we are going to deal with a question that was presented to us by a patron that we dealt with once before, but I think my two guests tonight are much better to deal with this question in a different way. And Alfred Tuttle suggested this question, and what he wants to know is, well, before I get to that, let me introduce Mr. Jeff Ritzman and Greg Bishop.
Hello there.
Hello.
And you two, this is like totally in your wheelhouse. So his question was, what is the evidence that whatever appears to be behind a myriad of phenomena, UFOs, Sasquatch, fairies, etc., is a non-human intelligence? How do we know it is not a manifestation caused by some kind of collective human unconsciousness? And what kinds of questions can we ask to determine which is the case?
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. I have no idea, and this question scared the crap out of me.
It's a great question, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I know. It's a great question. I would love to deal with it, and we will. I don't know how, but we will. Who has a good handle on this? The best thing I hear right away is, I don't know.
I wonder if how much it matters in the long run, whether or not this is a manifestation of us or something else out there or some combination therein.
I would say, yeah, exactly. My first answer would be yes. Seriously.
Yeah. Because it obviously this phenomena seems to interact with consciousness no matter what it is.
Right. Well, everything we do interacts with consciousness, but to varying levels of sophistication. You hit a rock and it reacts to consciousness by making a noise. And then you move up from that. I'm not joking about that.
No, I agree. But what I'm saying is, I don't think you have UFOs. Like take a classic landing thing where someone sees a UFO landed and they're collecting plants. And I think it was Vallée early on that said, this doesn't seem like something that's actually happening. This seems like something we're being shown.
Theater.
Mm-hmm. Right. Theater.
Yeah.
So it's not something, it seems like these things are happening because we're observing them. They're not just happening and we're happening upon them. And I think the fact that also people are repeating, have these repeat encounters also says something that it's connected deeply with our consciousness.
Yeah. If a UFO lands in the forest and collects samples and nobody's there to see it, is it actually landing in the forest?
Exactly. Thoughts, Jeff?
Whew. I go from kind of like internal or external, you know, which has always been kind of the forefront question of me is, you know, are these things internally generated or are they an external force of some kind? And the only way that I see it, I don't go so far as to say the collective unconscious or the collective consciousness manifesting something and then it becoming unhinged from the ego and wandering aimlessly around the earth. I don't know that I get that far with it, really. I go from internal, external. And the only thing that I can say from that standpoint is that the experience of a paranormal event always seems to be two things, very personal and probably in the same tangent line is, you know, tailored to the individual, expressed through cultural filters of some kind or another, right?
Yeah.
And so if it's that, then the other question I ask myself is like, well, can I predict what it will do? And the thing about this is that it will always shock, surprise you, come at the least appointed time that you could want, the most inopportune time. You can't anticipate it. In my mind, you can't anticipate it. Although, like I've spoken on your show before, Soraya, it's back in the days of my life being a three-ring circus with this stuff, which I think Greg kind of experienced the same thing in the way of like a paranoid effect, right?
Yeah, and associated physical things that other people can see. Yeah.
Right. So there's that point where I remember there is this distinct feeling in the house that people could feel, like people, not me, could feel. People, strangers could come into my house and go, what's going on in here? What is that? It would be like a heavy, and I always called it doom. It's a heck of a way to describe it, but that's just, it was a very oppressive, heavy, thick, uneasy feeling. And I could always kind of predict, I bet you something happens tonight that's very odd, but you couldn't predict when, what it would look like, if anything would be communicated to you or implied to you. You couldn't anticipate it. So at that point I go, okay, this seems external to me. Now, is that a right or wrong definition? I don't know. That's just how I categorize it to myself.
It's a philosophical question. It's not just a UFO question or a paranormal question.
Exactly.
You know, how much going on outside your head is actually going on outside your head?
Right.
Burning your hand, that's probably going on, and you get a definite feedback for it. That's something happening out, you know, that is affecting you, or, you know, a bomb going off or whatever. All these things are very robust kinds of manifestations. But when you get into something paranormal, it's not so robust, and it depends on the person. And like you said, Jeff, more like it's like set and setting almost, you know?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so if and both are very important, meaning that somebody like Jeff or people that he knows or somebody that's kind of a trigger will make these things work, and other people it won't happen around them. And, you know, from a skeptical side, you could say, well, because those people are nuts and they just see things other people don't, and they have fantasy prone personalities. But the thing is that somebody that isn't like that can also experience the thing around those people. So, I don't know if that means it's coming from outside the person, but, you know, if you look at the entire history of strange phenomena and whatever you want to call it, people encountering things that they can't quite explain, the fact that you can't predict it or, you know, don't expect it, or it's not, you know, it's not something that's repeatable in a way that we know that it would seem to me, unless your subconscious is working overtime to mess with you, which could happen, that there's a very good case to be made that it's external, but attenuated, shaped, remembered, whatever you want to call it, tuned by the individual consciousness or a collective consciousness of if more than one person's seeing it, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Yeah. It's like it needs to, we can't see it as what it is. So it needs to kind of form to our perception levels.
Or we form into our perception levels.
Right.
Go on.
In one of my essays, I said, are we dealing with something that holds up a mirror every time we get too close? I think that's, you know, one of my, that's something I want to put in a t-shirt, you know, that I think that's an important question to me.
The oppression thing. I don't think I remember you talking about that before, Jeff. The one graveyard down in Ithaca that I've had a lot of weird experiences with, I can usually tell when something is there, because right around the Civil War section of it, you can feel a really strong sense of oppression.
Yeah.
And it makes you want to run. I mean, it makes you feel like there's something there that doesn't want you there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, interestingly enough, it was when people would walk literally through the threshold of the house. So the minute they would cross the threshold of the house, they would, I mean, I remember a couple coming over for dinner one night, and my friend Brian walked in and he said, "What is going on in here?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, "You don't feel that?" I was like, "I feel it. What do you feel?" And yeah. he's like, "It feels like a bomb's about to go off in this place." He's like, "It's like I'm on the edge of something." You know, he's like, "The minute I walked in, I felt like I was walking across a 2x4 on a skyscraper." And I'm like, "Okay, well, that's an interesting way to look at it." Cause I see it as like this heavy, oppressive, thick doom. And there were other, I mean, Jeremy and I particularly noticed it would happen when we got into really incredibly deep conversations with guests on Paratopia. Like we had, of all people, Colin Andrews on one night, and we began talking about his experiences in the fields of England, where they would record very strange sounds in these formations, notice gravitational pulls in these things. Pretty well documented evidence of really strange stuff that doesn't feel like any categorizable, you know, paranormal phenomena. But yet there it was. We would get into this deep conversation about these things, and all of a sudden the air would just change. And I remember at a certain point in the interview, it was a recorded show, so it wasn't live. I said out loud, "So are we all going to pretend that nobody else feels that in here, or is it just me?" And Colin goes, "No, I know exactly what you're talking about. You feel that, the air?" And I'm like, "Yes, the air." And he said, "Yeah, I just had a whole bank of computers to my right shut down." And he doodled some very strange things that I was beginning to talk about. And it was before I spoke about them. And it was all a matter of weird stuff before, during, and after that. That interview that just were beyond the pale of bizarre. And one of them I even hesitate to mention because it's so incredibly weird.
Now you gotta mention it.
Crap. You know you want to mention it.
I do and I don't, because it's fascinating as hell, but so I went to sleep two nights after that interview. I think it was two nights afterwards. And I sleep like the dead. I don't have dreams for the most part. I have nightmares. And when I have nightmares, I usually wake up from them. And so I'm asleep and I kind of wake up laying in my bed. And I'm admittedly in that hypnopompic, hypnagogic state. But I'm awake and I'm kind of laying there looking at my eyelids shut. And I see what looks like Egyptian thematic eyes. So I've got the blue around the outer edge, a very dark pupil or iris, and then the lines going out from the lateral sides, right? So I'm looking at this, and my head identifies this with Colin Andrews. Why? I have no idea whatsoever why. And so in my head, I say, "Colin?" And it says, "Jeff." And I'm like, "Colin?" And he's like, "Jeff." And I was like, "What is this?" And he goes, "I have no idea what's going on right now. This is the most bizarre thing." I said, "What is this? Why do your eyes look like this?" And that's all I could see was the eyes. And I mean, I just remember being absolutely flabbergasted. I said, all of this is happening behind closed eyes in my head. And I'm saying, "Colin, you need to remember this. Do not forget about this, because I'm going to contact you tomorrow about this. You need to remember this. I will. So I write him the next day. I said, Colin, do you remember what happened last night? And he says, I remember I didn't get a lot of sleep, but I can't remember what happened, but I know something happened. And I said, and then I explained it to him. And he says, well, I don't remember any of that, but I know that I didn't get a lot of sleep, that I felt like there was talking going on, but I don't remember anything like what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very, just very bizarre, unexplainable to me, unless you just say, well, that's dream and that's, you know, suggestion and all. And it could be. But all of these things just kind of pelted us. And Jeremy had a very odd dreamlike sequence as well at the same time. I think involving a Native American and a movie theater, and you'll have to get him to tell you, but we both had very, very weird things go on during that interview and after it that to me just equate to those really weird questions that you just don't normally talk about. And I don't know how else to put it than that, you know, to say that there are certain questions you don't ask because you feel like if you ask them, people are going to think you're a weirdo. Or, now, I do art for a living. I could give a crap if people think I'm a weirdo, you know? So it's like, I ask them, you know, and try and put it out there. Because to me, you know, devil's in the details for that kind of stuff. So,
I think fascinating.
Did he have anything happen that lasted for a while, or just you just asked him about the dream thing?
Well, I mean, there was. I asked him about the dream thing. I asked him had anything odd happen, and he mentioned something. I'll have to dig up the email. It's been years ago, but he had. And then he mentioned, you know, what had happened during the interview, and how he was actually getting ready to say, "Does anybody else feel that?" before I said it. So it's something that you can, it's palpable. I mean, you can feel that the air gets kind of bristly and I don't know what that means. And I don't know if that's like, okay, is that internal or external? I have no idea, but clearly when it affects three people, what does that mean? You know, if somebody walking into the environment can feel it, that smells external to me, but that's not necessarily a quantifiable thing. You can't qualify something just because other people feel it. That doesn't necessarily mean it's still not an effect coming from me or from, you know, the environment itself. I don't know. It's a coin flip to me. I mean, but as far as internal, external, you know, the fact that I think that you can't predict it, that holds a little bit of water with me, but I think we're all going to be a lot better off when people at large accept the fact that, you know, there's always this pervasive notion in any paranormal field that we must refute the psychological, you know, we must refute at all costs. The psychological must not be blamed for this. And so, you know,
obvious that that's kind of at the center.
And I go, well, it's all psychological, you know, you know, like everything you do is psychological one way or another. So let's stop doing that and realize that on some level, it's a loop. It's something is out there. Something is there enough. I'll put it to you this way, enough to manifest people collecting samples, soil samples for decades on end. Or advanced beyond our wildest capacity for advancement, aliens coming here from another world and using knives on people. Like, does something seem unbalanced about that to anyone else?
Yeah.
And yet these things are so obvious, and yet no one talks about them. You know, like, very few people will mention that. Like, this is askew. Something doesn't. Yeah. There's
that's
always
this
nudge
and
wink. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm always trying to do that. I'm trying to do that runaround now. It's like, well, if we hack ourselves to figure out why we see these things, maybe some answers or understanding will come out of that rather than trying to figure out what planet they're from and why they're cutting us open.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and well, and then I get the obvious question, you know, well, then what goes on in radar cases or when people have photos? And Like, I don't think I'm talking about it. I think I'm talking about Close Encounters. Because, you know, you can take pictures of stuff. It's like, okay, there's a picture of something. What does that prove? That the camera picked up something or the radar picked up something.
Doesn't tell you a thing.
No, it just tells you that there's something you don't know about. And that's about it. And what does that do? It's like, if we just got one perfect picture or video, then everybody would believe. No, they wouldn't. It wouldn't make any difference whatsoever. Yeah. Believers would believe and disbelievers would disbelieve. That's just the way it's going to be.
It doesn't matter how good it is. I mean, no matter how good the evidence is. No, not at all.
If it looks too good, it's like that one with that video people are putting up now with that thing that opens up in the sky and the thing. And somebody made the comment. You've seen that video, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And somebody made the comment. I agree completely. That looks too good. So anything that looks perfect, it's like this proves it, is automatically going to be suspect. But then somebody shows you something that's completely insane. You know, like an alien runs at the camera, turns into a werewolf, and then throws confetti at you or something like that. You know, that would be really good evidence for something strange going on, because why the hell would you videotape something like that? That's ridiculous. Yeah. And to me, that argues for its authenticity. But the thing is, it doesn't make any difference to anybody else. It's just a non-starter with most people. If they could figure out that it wasn't fake, they'd see, it's like, that's so stupid that it doesn't, you know, doesn't fit any paradigm. It doesn't prove anything. To me, it proves that perhaps that we're complicit in creating the reality that can be seen by other people, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and a camera, actually. You know, I'm trying to crack that one now. How much can we affect the environment? If anybody has any answers on this, how much can we affect the environment so that it becomes physically manifest to the point where other people on instruments pick it up? I think that's an important question. Not saying that's what happens, but I think that's a very interesting question to me. Do either of you think that's BS, or is it
no.
Or is it pursuable, do you think?
Definitely. And when you look at like poltergeist cases, isn't that exactly what's happening? They may not be doing it intentionally, but you have people manifesting, psychic ability, basically, that they're not even aware of.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like the Philip thing, which is now being brought up on Coast to Coast, much to my chagrin, but whatever. Not because I think it's cool or anything like that, but because, you know, does it help anything, or does it, you know, does it make people actually think, or they just say, oh, that's something weird. No, I think it's like right in the wheelhouse of what's going on. If you can make something up and it manifests, holy crap, that's like, you know, what if we can get everybody to do that, or a lot of people do? Which is why I asked Jeff to continue on my show, and I said, well, how do you see your own UFO? And he goes, I don't know if I should say this. And I said, yes, please say it. Tell everybody how to do it, because I want to see what happens, and I want to see what people say. And if I get a chance, I want to try it myself. I'm not, you know, I'm a little bit apprehensive, but you know, if a lot of people or more than half the population tries something and they get a result, that's a lot more important than a stupid video.
Yeah, and if only 50% of them go absolutely crazy from it and end up in an institution, that's an acceptable loss.
I think so.
I mean, my answer to that is science. I think you saying make something up and it having an effect, I think that's the key right there, is that whatever is going to be attempted with that has to be a creative process. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes total sense. Because it's creative on its own without you controlling. How about you controlling the creativity and see what happens?
Right. Well, and then we're going back to one of the Word of the Road Go shows on the Tulpa, right? The Tulpa creation thing.
Right, but
we could go even so far as to say, forget the Tulpa thing, forget something being summoning to do bidding of any kind. And this is something that I mentioned some years ago on Paratopia to Jeremy. I said, you know, when it comes to cases like Gulf Breeze, I mean, Gulf Breeze is still one of those ones that levels in this limbo period of, is it believable or is it not? Is there's pro things for it, and there's so many things against it, but I think by and large it's still to most people who care enough to look at this thing, it's still a kind of like, it's interesting. There's something interesting here. And I often wonder, you know, people talk about, you know, Ed Walters and all that, and that being kind of the genesis. And it's not the genesis of the whole thing in Gulf Breeze by any stretch. He's not the beginning nor the end of it.
Right.
But when it comes to it, let's say for the sake of argument, and I am not saying this, audience, I am not a believer in this notion, but let's say Ed Walters faked it. Let's say he faked it. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, after he fakes him and after all this attention and all this focus is put on looking for UFOs in the skies over Shoreline Park, guess what shows up? UFOs in the sky over Shoreline Park. And so when I asked Bland Pugh, rest in peace, you know, when did people stop seeing UFOs at Shoreline Park? His answer to me was unequivocally, when people stopped going to see them. Now, does that say anything about the to and fro, or, you know, like, I'm not saying Ed Walters faked anything. What I'm saying is, if he would have, or if someone would that have been enough? I mean, his photos were very exciting photographs in that period.
Yeah,
we've all become really accustomed to seeing them now. But back then, this was like pretty amazing stuff. And so it really lit a fire under people to see these things. And one by one, people began seeing things. I recorded a daylight UFO in there in 97, I think it was, or 98. You know, and people looked at it and said, it's definitely the Ed Walters craft. Now, I don't know that it was. It was very far away. Could have been an airplane. Does it matter? It doesn't matter. Because if people believe that's a UFO, and some people don't, it is still exists in that in-between place, which is the liminal period, and it still becomes what it is. And so it continues on. You know, so do these things manifest by virtue of hoax? You know, that's the next blog post on the Numinous Net. You know, you know, so, I mean, it's a really interesting wrinkle that, you know, could you, like, I'm not going to kid. I have tossed around buying a big helium balloon and a string of LED lights, battery operated, running a ring around them, getting myself a nice long tether, and letting that thing fly above the town here in Gunpowder that I live in. I just leave it up for like 10 minutes and then somehow remote control turn those lights off. So it just disappears into blackness. What would happen? I'm not going to promote it. I'm not going to say anything. I'm going to let people photograph it. I'm going to let reporters report it. What happens next? I keep the thing on the ground from there. Do people see things in the sky after that? I wonder. You know,
I had a guy on my show with Adam Gorightly, a guy named John Fenderson. He told me, and I put this in the essay for Robbie's book for Reframing the Debate. He said in the 70s, when he was a young lad, or at least a teenager, he and his friends sent up a bunch of laundry bag hot air, you know, with the candles.
Oh, yeah.
They sent up, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 8 of them. And he said that, they just let them off over the town, I guess some mid-sized town somewhere, I think in California. And he said that people called the police. There were people saying there was an alien invasion. They had seen spacecraft or whatever. And it went all the way from that to people said they had seen floating laundry bags with candles in them. So he said it seemed like whatever people wanted to see in those things is what they saw. Even though he knew and his friends knew there were laundry bags with candles in them.
What I found interesting is a few years, maybe about 2 years ago, Google lost one of their balloons or one of their blimps or whatever it was. Yeah. And it set off a series of UFO sightings in the like Tennessee area, wherever it was. And when you looked at the reports were pretty dead on about what this thing looked like. Because you get a lot, well, people don't know what they're seeing. But people were saying, yeah, I saw a UFO. It looked exactly like this. And all the reports pretty much matched up and described this Google blimp.
Oh, okay.
And I'm thinking, okay, so people's reports are actually not as inaccurate as some people would like to believe.
Yeah.
You know,
I think it varies. Yeah, and my point of mentioning that is not to say that, you know, that, UFOs or hoaxes or people, you know, people don't know what they're looking at. It's just that whether it's unidentified or not, people's set, you know, their set and setting or whatever you want to call it, that really determines what they see. And you know, if I was a, you know, hardcore rabid skeptic, I'd, you know, it's like, well, then, you know, people, you can't rely on anybody's testimony. It's like, yeah, well, yes, you can. Even if it's unidentified, I think that, the testimony is, should be paid attention to, although not taken horribly seriously on a case by case basis, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. But what found is so interesting about that blimp is that it did show that even though some people thought it was a spaceship, et cetera, et cetera, the actual descriptions were pretty dead on.
Right.
Which says that people are very capable of describing what they see, what they may ascribe to that is it may vary, but their actual observational skills are not as bad, you know, because you get skeptics who will say, oh, well, people just have bad observational skills. They're just, you know, they see this, but they're really seeing something completely different. But that, I think, shows us that that may not really be the case.
Well, I think when it comes to, and this is something I think that at this point, I think we kind of, if we haven't established much in this UFO study, I think the one thing we've established in some semblance of order is that when there are multiple people viewing some kind of UFO manifestation of one kind or another, that they report different things, that people perceive mm-hmm. different aspects of this. If it was orange to one, it'll be blue to another. If it was round, it'll be boxy. If it's long, it'll be short. There's all of these different discrepancies that are pretty dramatic to say that, that notion that you just pointed out, Soraya, that, you know, people are pretty accurate, but when it comes to looking at it from a skeptical angle, it's, well, if the skeptical angle is looking at all reports across the board, they're going to ignore the one from the Google blimp. They're going to focus on the things that people report akin to the phenomena out here. And of course that, you know, almost, you know, on cue seems to purport itself to be self-negating. You can't trust what they see. You can't look at the pictures, right? The pictures are all blurry and out of focus. We hear this all the time. And again, it's one of my big contentions that this is ambiguous free reason, you know, and, you know, I think Greg mentioned something like it's more attention worthy if it looks bizarre or if it doesn't seem quite right. That seems to be the one you want to look at a little bit more. Now, that's not saying every stringed UFO is an alien craft. No. There's plenty of hoaxes. We got that. But what people see in relation to this phenomena is notoriously unreliable. So I think that's where that notion or that stereotype comes from, is that you can't trust witnesses to UFO events. I think that comes from the self-negated aspect that it is. You know, we're witnessing exactly what it does.
So that being the case, could it in part be that, like, when people are seeing a real typical object like that blimp, their reports are pretty uniform across the board, suggesting that this is not something anomalous because everyone is kind of seeing the same thing.
I think that could be like a really close first preliminary step in saying what is and what is not a project of the U.S. government, which, you know, I get so tired of hearing UFO researchers out there say, you know, I mean, I shouldn't blame him for it, but I call it a Dolanism, where I hear things like, we don't have technology back in the 40s that could do this, you know, or we don't have technology that can do this kind of maneuver today. My question is, how the hell do you know? No one is privy to every project of every government on this planet. We don't know that. But if people report the same exact thing, traveling in the same kind of way, then maybe we've got something there that could be kind of contained. This has always been the big problem for me and UFOs, is how does someone take a report and say, this is the phenomena, or this is not, this is clearly some project, you know, it had rivets, it had wings, you know, well, what's the stop, one or the other? There's no, where's the line of demarcation? I think that could be your first bit.
John Keel also mentioned, I forget which book it was in, but he talks about like airplanes that are seen that make absolutely no noise, glide closely to the ground, mm-hmm. kind of slowly. And he's like, yeah, people just... Was it in Mothman?
Okay. Some of it in Mothman, but maybe some in like, you know, Trojan Horse and stuff like that. But yeah, you're right.
But he, you know, and he points out that this is not a normal airplane. Planes don't do this. But yet people will kind of overlook it.
Yeah, you're getting because, into ghost rocket territory almost.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, what's weird and what's not?
Mm-hmm. I got a patron question that I would ask.
Yeah.
Given all that we're talking about, why are there no close-up pictures of craft, of creatures? Why not? There's plenty of far-away pictures of craft. None of them, like, you know, from 20 feet away.
Hmm.
That's a tough one. Yeah, exactly. But, the, you know, if it's that physical and anybody can, you know, and it's, you know... It can be witnessed, and it's a physical thing, and people coming from other planets. What the hell is going on? Of course, you know, people are going to say, well, the aliens won't let you. Well, setting that BS aside, you know.
Well, there is the electromagnetic aspect of it. I mean, you have cars stopping and things like that, showing sort of an electromagnetic field that interferes with electronics.
Yeah.
But so the closer you are, the less likely I'm thinking stuff like that would work. I can say when I saw my giant UFO, a picture was the last thing I thought about. Yeah. I didn't have a camera with me, but I had a video camera in the back seat. I mean, this was 2000 or 2001. Yeah. So it was like a VHS-C camera. It wasn't like, you know, something I could easily whip out. But I was more interested in observing the thing and trying to pick out as much information about it as I could. And when it finally dropped out of sight, I went, and I had my camera in the back seat.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people say, I watched it for a while, then I ran to get my camera, and I came back, it was gone in a few seconds.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to show you, this is your show, but you're not allowed to take no pictures allowed. No flash photography, no pictures.
I tend to think when it comes to UFO stuff or UFO sightings like these things in the sky that are seen at distances and whatnot, I just want to say, is it like the water on the road illusion, where the closer you get, the less there it is, you know, like a mirage-like quality, you know, or a ghost quality. I mean, I like Terrence McKenna's notion of, you know, UFOs are ghosts haunting the skies of Earth. I like that. I like that for some reason. In that they're just as, you know, well, that's the question, isn't it? well, that's not a productive question to ask, Greg. I don't know, but it's like, it's one of those things where, you know, I have seen, a big headed thing, in my room, and it was, I'm standing right about where it would be. So it was by a yardstick away from my face. picture again, last thing on my mind.
Yeah, getting to the point where you can't even have automatic, you know, cameras pick any of this stuff up.
Yeah, I didn't have them at that point, but even if I did, I looked at it and didn't even realize what it was, you know, and yet I'm seeing shoulders, head, you know, eyes, mouth, very fuzzy, albeit the features, but it was there. It was solid. The light was reflecting off of it.
Yeah.
The question is, if I'd have put my finger out, would it have hit something?
Yeah, I mean, well, people have said that they have. My question, and I've been asking this for a long time, and I'm still wondering about it, if I was standing 10 miles away with the most powerful telescope ever, as if I could be standing right next to you, if I was standing 10 miles away when you had that kind of experience, was able to look at it through that telescope, what would I see?
Yeah, that's a damn good question. Here's the answer to that, I guess.
Yeah.
When I woke out of a dead sleep and saw this thing, I thought it might have been either a fan that was sitting on the desk, you know, the rounded fan, or clothes on the back of a chair. That's what I thought it was. And, I leaned up, I looked at it. And when I leaned up on my elbow to lean in closer to look at it, it leaned back away from me. And in my head, I went, did that just move? What is that? I mean, I was really confused about what am I looking at? And so for some reason, I just said, F it. And I flopped back on the pillow and I was out. I mean, I just went right back to sleep. Now, that's really unusual typical. For me to, that really is unusual for me to wake up in the middle of the night at all. But then I think that was a Sunday night. And I want to say it was like Tuesday. A friend of mine came over. I remembered it when I woke up. I thought about it a lot. There was nothing on the table. There was nothing on the chair. There was no way from my vantage point that should have looked like that. So that immediately concerned me because I know what it looked like then. And I had a great deal of apprehension about such a thing. I didn't open my mouth about it. Tuesday night, a friend of mine came over for dinner and he knows about stuff that we've seen in the house. And he says, has anything happened in the house lately? And I said, no, but I'd be a little, I'd be not wanting to talk about what I thought I saw beside the bed the other night. And my wife says, I already know, big head, little shoulders, bed, staring at us.
Damn
and I'm like, you saw that? I mean, my feet went bone ice cold. And I'm like, oh, no, you did not just say that. You did not just say that.
Right. I didn't want you to say that.
No. And she described it exactly. Here's the interesting bit for her. She woke up after I flopped down. That woke her up. She looked over, saw it very clearly, apparently.
Same thing?
She rubbed her eyes.
When
she took her hands down from her eyes, it wasn't there.
Yeah.
When she rubbed her eyes again and looked, it was back.
Hmm.
And then she just rolled over and said to herself, there's no way I can tell Jeff about this. And yeah, that was it. Yeah, now, when I called Tyler Coach on the next morning on the way to work and told him, and he goes, that's brilliant. That's amazing. You know, I was like, no, it's not amazing. It's not brilliant because now I can't sleep anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, for like a week, exactly. I didn't go to bed until like 6 a.m. So, you know,
I don't know why this go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought.
No, that's it. I mean, that's really the crux of it. I mean, we both saw it and both didn't tell each other about it. And that to me, like that was extremely, visceral to me because I didn't feel anything about it and I didn't feel anything from it. Like there's a distinctive, there's a thing when these things are around, whether they're half there or all the way there, that I think I've described before, like they're really hard to be around. The manifestation of these little people,
yeah,
these big heads, they're really hard to be around. And I rarely have been able to look them in the face. But this one, I was looking right in his face and it was very dark, but I could clearly see from the light coming through the window, I could clearly see his head. I could clearly see the make out of eyes and mouth. And he was extremely wrinkled and old looking. But I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel like a wizened feeling. I didn't feel an old feeling or a man or a woman. It was blank. And he was just standing there staring like he couldn't figure my ugly ass out. That's the only thing I can describe is like just a stare down. And then when I lean towards him and he backs away or it backs away, I'm like, okay, why did I not freak out at that? I immediately should have known what that was. Like, what would have happened if I'd have reached over and turned on the light? And my instincts tell me when I turned on the light, there would have been nothing there.
Right.
Right.
But I don't know that.
The act of trying to figure it out, it's kind of like meditating. You reach a point of like Satori, and as soon as you get into the going, you know, and this happened to me, going, being engaged, giving into the amazement, it stops it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The minute you try to hold on to it, it's
gone. Yeah. Exactly.
Of course,
go ahead.
There's always the trap of saying, ooh, look how good I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as ego enters into it, that screws it up too, I think.
Yeah.
And the big difference in that experience and any other one that I've ever had of weird people is I think I know exactly how to bring that on again. But I'm not doing it.
No, you wouldn't.
I'm not doing it until I know I can have enough presence of mind not only to handle it, but to realize what's going on, if that makes any sense.
That makes, you know? It makes total sense to me.
So, oddly enough, the thing that I would do to exacerbate something like that to happen again is the most marginal thing I could possibly imagine.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, when you talk about crystals and rocks and all this kind of stuff, I am a non-believer in, you know, crystal power and all that. No, I'm sorry. But that's exactly what happened the day of that.
Yeah, so, you put a charged crystal against
on my forehead. Yeah. So
well, that's right. I remember you talked about that. Yeah.
You know, I just think to myself, well, if you want it again, that's kind of what you have to do. And it's still out there in the dirt. So, you know, soaking up the juice, so to speak. So, you know, I mean, I wonder about, you know, one day, am I going to get just depressed enough about this subject that I'm going to go, yeah, to hell with it. I'm going to do it. But I'm always going to remember how that felt. So I like my sleep a little too much.
Yeah. I don't know why this I don't even know if this is relevant, but it affected me. And I only thought of it again now. When I was a teenager, I went to Washington, D.C. on a trip with my dad and my sister, because my dad would just, you know, take us on trips and show us stuff. Like, let's go to the Grand Canyon. So this time we went to D.C., you know, to look at the museums and all that. I'm in the hotel room with them, and I'm on a cot, and my dad has a bed, and my sister has a bed. It's like it's 5 in the morning. The sun's just coming up. I wake up and look at my dad and my sister, and they're both turned towards me, you know, sleeping sideways, soundly. And as I look at them, I notice their eyes are wide open, like cartoonishly wide open. And I'm thinking, am I dreaming? And I'm getting more and more terrified by the moment. And then their eyes start moving around like they're like crazy cartoon insane eyes. Huh. And I know they're asleep and their eyes are closed, but I was too scared to get up and go closer to see if I was just imagining it or whatever. But it just scared me. It was deep, like, fear. And I just sat there like with the covers up, just staring at them going, this isn't happening. This isn't happening. Oh my God, this isn't happening. Then I don't remember if I went to sleep or it just, you know, gradually faded away. I can't remember which, but it was a frightening sight to see your father and your sister with giant cartoon googly eyes moving around, moving around independently of each other. Well, I don't know why.
What was the level of light in there, Greg?
It was like, you know, just enough to see. Mm. Well, you know what? I could see the beds and I could see the covers and the folds and the covers and all that, but just barely.
Okay. A lot of very odd things happen in that light. You know, you ever notice that? I mean, I know there's illusionary stuff that happens, but, you know, I remember, like you say, as a kid, you know, having a poster on your wall of some kind and that icy dawn light, that odd blue color. There you'll get a lot of movement from inanimate objects in that kind of light.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. You know, I know it was probably my imagination working.
Yeah, I don't know what it is either. I don't know what technical term there is for that. But yeah, I mean, and again, I look at those kind of things and I go, well, if you saw it, you know what I mean? It's like where did that come from?
Yeah, you know, and I didn't dare ask him about it later. Hey, did you guys wake up at like 5 in the morning and stare at with your eyes open far more than you could possibly open them?
Right. Yeah.
Were you guys doing that? Were you just messing with me or?
Yeah.
Because I knew that wasn't the case.
Right.
But I didn't know what had happened. Of course, you know, and it never happened again. But and that's one of the few times I can remember I have some kind of something in that light. You know, and it wasn't hypnagogic. I was wide awake.
Weird.
Especially after I saw what was going on, and I was like, "Oh, I'm just imagining this." And then it got it got more and more clear as I got more and more afraid.
Wow,
so, very strange. I mean, not to the point where it's like, you know, crystal clear, but enough so that if the light was shining on their eyes and they were doing that, there would be enough to see that. I mean, I could see the whites and the irises in there, but they were spinning around.
Yeah, I just caught a mental image of like a flashlight going across that scene. You got a horror movie there, pal. I mean,
yeah, I know. Right, you know what it reminded me of is when Roger Rabbit, when they tear off Christopher, what's the guy's name?
Lloyd.
Christopher Lloyd's thing, and his like googly cartoon eyes.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's how frightening it was to me.
Yeah, I can imagine. Jeez.
And this was before that movie too. So but that's the only thing I can really compare it to.
Yeah. That's bizarre.
Hmm.
So I don't know if that's relevant to the discussion, but the fact that something so normal and so, you know, I'm just seeing people sleeping in the morning could turn into something so terrifying is kind of weird. And, you know, how does that, you know, is that what's going on in some, when somebody sees a presence in the room? I don't know. I mean, exactly. There might be an element of that. And like, I'm pretty sure that wasn't happening in real life, but the thing is that I saw it and it was real to me. So that remains interesting to me, just like contactees are interesting to me. I don't know if I believe them, but the phenomenon, the social phenomenon, interests me a great deal. So trying to be clinical about something that affects somebody very deeply and emotionally is another like hobby horse I have right now. Just not getting emotionally involved or egotistically involved with looking at the subject might help too. And that's too bad because then you can't have big organizations, TV shows, book tours, movies, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm sorry about that. But I think if that stuff was taken out of the picture or generally taken out of the picture, or when somebody thinks they have something important, generally shutting up about it, I think that might help too.
Well, but if somebody has something important, shouldn't they be sharing it?
No, they should share it when they've decided that they have finished their project or that they should share it with somebody. So I got that you. Others can, you know, basically, you know, do your work, make sure it's, you know, and get to the point where you figure it's over or you say, this is as far as I can go with it. Now let's share it with somebody else, tell somebody exactly what we or I did and see what they can do with that. Maybe they can repeat it. Maybe they can develop it. Maybe they can confirm it, whatever. But I think that should be the new model. And I already see people doing that.
Hmm.
Or you don't tell them the outcome and you just do it blind.
Yeah, exactly.
Which to me would seem almost more valuable to have that, you know, to have, I mean, the easiest way to do that is
write
your thing down and put it in a self-addressed stamped envelope and have it postmarked with a date or something, you know?
Right. Or at least tell people, look, do this. And then don't tell them anything else.
Right. Right.
And see what happens. That's another, I never really thought of it that way, but that's perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Did you find yourself standing at the large fire pit like me? You know?
Yeah. I mean, don't say that. That's immediately, that's a good, like, you know, like the person with the headache that I talked about with the MUFON guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You heard that, right, Soraya?
I did, but I don't remember.
I was talking to a guy from MUFON. He said that he had spoken to a woman that had an extremely strange experience, which I won't go into, you know, involved like glowing orbs and a giant rabbit with plaid colored fur, which I love.
Hmm.
But he said that he talked to her about the experience, you know, what happened? What did you see? How fast was the car going? What time of night was it? Where do you live? You know, where are you from? And all the, you know, normal stuff. And then he said, you know, have you had any noticeable health problems, you know, in the last few hours? Cause they called him the next day. And she said, no, I haven't noticed anything really. And then I asked her if she'd had any things like, you know, migraines or something. And I looked at the guy, stopped, and I said, you shouldn't have asked her that. And he looked at me like I was crazy. He's like, no, that's our normal question. He said, but it's funny you say that. Cause I called her the next day and she said, an hour after we hung up, she had a huge, massive headache. I said, well, can't you see that, you know? And he could not see that that was a leading question. It was actually hurting the witness.
Yeah.
Because they're looking at the MUFON person as basically as a confessor and a professional that's going to help them. So,
and an authority.
Yeah, an authority. And the authority says I should have headaches. So subconsciously, it's like, my God, this is the weirdest thing that ever happened to me. I can't stand it. I got to have some kind of closure. So I guess part of that is to have a massive migraine.
You know, when we're talking about how to determine which is which, part of me says, well, you know, if it is us, it can't tell us stuff we don't know, but I'm not sure that's totally true either. Because obviously we have people who are psychic who pick up information, and I've been told many things that turned out to be true that I couldn't possibly have had any knowledge of. But at the same time, if we have a higher self that knows more, it doesn't necessarily, you know, there's no way to tell the difference there if this is an external entity or telling us this, or our higher self or our psychic ability picking up on this information.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, as we said at the beginning, I think it's a non-starter. It's kind of a semantic question that is might not be important. I'm not sure. The internal-external thing is the, you know, the subject-object thing. I think with paranormal, especially UFO stuff, kind of breaks down. And we have to really examine how that breakdown happens and where it happens, how it manifests, and how our primitive, you know, ape brains deal with it. If that makes sense.
No, totally.
It's not to say we shouldn't think about it, but I just think it's not, if you just keep saying, is there some other thing here? It's like to me asking, where are the aliens coming from? It's a more sophisticated way of saying that.
I feel like this is what makes the study of the UFO phenomena important, because it makes us look at this stuff so much deeper. Like this stuff ties in directly with consciousness, which ties in directly with what reality is, what life is, why we're here, and all this type of stuff. And what's so unfortunate is so much of the UFO research is just down to, well, what you just said, where are the aliens coming from?
Yeah. And I think that's changing. We're talking about it. I hear it on your show a lot. I have people talking about this stuff on my show all the time. The people in Robbie's book are going to talk about it. And I think it's spreading, and I think that's a good thing, because people are tired of, you know, gathering data and nothing changing. So let's turn to where, you know, the pioneers like Valle and Hansen and Keel and Greg Little and people like that are coming from. Keith Thompson, as I mentioned on Jeff's blog on a comment the other day. Let's look and see where these people were mining, you know, what they were mining and trying to get at in the 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, and revive that and push it further and see what happens, because, you know, doing it the old way it's just not working. I think the old way is valuable, and people should keep doing it, but because patterns can emerge from data that you would probably never expect. Although there should be different ways of asking the questions or not being so leading or whatever. As Jeff, Jeremy, and Tyler and a couple other people did with Core, which I thought was an amazing start. The whatever psychosocial hypothesis or whatever, however you want to put it down, has been overlooked, and I think that should be on the ascendant. Whether it provides any answers or not, it has. I don't think it's been pursued enough by enough people with the brains to pursue it properly, and that's changing. It's changing right now as we're sitting here talking.
I've always liked how Strieber would say that it could be the force of evolution staring us in the face, because understanding this stuff could do just that on a deeper level.
Yeah, I remember I recorded a presentation by Bud Hopkins in 1987, I think. Real early on. I mean, I was just getting back into this, and I remember one line he said that in his talk that we videotaped on 3/4-inch tape machines was a lot of these things that he was studying. He said UFO study or abduction research may be dragging us kicking and screaming into a new science or a new era or a new something. And whatever you think about Bud Hopkins or whatever he did, I think, you know, that reminded me of that quote, and I think it's significant. Maybe not in the exact way that he said it, but in a broader sense.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff?
No comment on Bud Hopkins.
yes.
I'm not a baby with the bathwater thing.
No,
it's Sean Morton, then I don't care.
Right.
I went to that trial for one day, actually.
Oh, my God. I'm really sorry.
I wanted to see.
I think when you're talking about the crux question here of of what we started out with, I think probably the best way or the best answer that I got is that I think the best way to get to an answer to that question is to start examining what surrounds the paranormal event. Again, that a lot of people don't.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, you know, like we don't have researchers out there asking the right questions, and we've got them all focused upon what the manifestation is. And that's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like saying, why does the car run well? Let me look at the wheels. And the engine is chugging underneath and you're not even paying attention to that. Right. So it's like, you know, we seem to be focused on what's the mechanics of the manifestation rather than, you know, what was going on here, what was happening in this environment, who saw what at what point in their lives, under what pretense, why were you there? This is a question that, you know, very rarely gets answered or gets asked in this field is, why were you at such and such a place? Travis, why were you in the woods? Well, I was coming in from work. Great answer. Okay, now what? Well, we don't get that with a lot of other people. Like, why were you in this space? What were you doing? What was your pretense for coming out here? Would you say, oh, you were walking here? Great. What did you see in the sky? You know, that's not getting anybody anywhere. So I think if we're going to find the answer to these really leap ahead questions, which that kind of is, you know, we need to start again and look at what is surrounding all of these things, and you'll see the consistencies that I talk about in those. And they're not always like, they're not the easiest things to accept. Because a lot of the things that I talk about on the blog and a lot of things I talk about on these shows, it's like a lot of these things, you could see the skeptical community taking a hold of these things and running with them all on their own. But you know, and I'm just saying this because it needs to be said. I've never written this anywhere, but they can't do that because these are not finished ideas. These are abstract concepts. And so when you're talking about an abstract concept, where we would go with it will be fleshed out much more thoroughly than anything that they would be able to come to an end with. In other words, there is no end to what I'm presenting. It's a question. It's a framework in which to build off of. I only hope that somebody can build even more off of it. But I'm sensing just from the comments that I saw today, which I just saw today from the past couple of months, you know, I'm seeing that there is this slight pushback against some of these things like anti-structure and people saying, well, what about I had one question asked. They said, well, what about all of the lab experience on Psi and all of these things? And my answer was going to be something along the lines of, well, lab-controlled environments, lab-controlled, like, when's the last time you heard about a lab-controlled poltergeist?
Yeah.
Anybody?
So, you can't.
I mean, you could take the entity case and say that could have been something, but, you know, again, that's really far in the past. What about now? What is the paranormal or parapsychological community doing now? And the answer is, not much. Nothing real has been done in that field for about 10 years.
Yeah, they're walking around with night vision cameras trained on themselves going, well, did you hear that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's your performance investigators. I mean, like parapsychologists in parapsychology doing controlled experiments of one kind or another, Ganzfeld or whatever. They're looking at these things, but there's not really anything new being done or attempted or tried. It's all kind of like, it seems to be like this rehashing of stuff that was done 10, 20 years ago.
Right.
And so, you know, when you start looking at these different modalities of thinking about this stuff, you're going to get this pushback of, well, what about, and my answer to this guy ultimately was, those experiments, compare that to the amount of reported phenomena. You know, you're going to see greatly diminished returns in the lab setting than you will out in the wilds where things can happen and where things can be chaotic and out of control. You're going to get more. So ultimately, it's like, you know, it's not a hard and fast rule. It doesn't apply 100% of the time, but the bulk of things seem to be surrounded by these tenets. And to see them in a lab setting removed, you may get something just by virtue of trying to put the anti-structural in a structured box. And
yeah,
that
like,
in
like
itself is an anti-structural move.
Yeah, like now, Princeton Engineering's Anomalies Research or Raiden or people like that.
Exactly. So there's box in a box outside a box. And, you know, and so ultimately still, you're still dealing with this marginal, you know, marginal people. You're dealing with a marginal study, a fringe study that not a lot of the public wants to see tackled in a credible, monetarily backed way. You know what I mean?
Jeffrey Kripal, I think he was on Rune Soup, and he made the comment that the paranormal or these sort of supernatural type of things happen in life for a reason. And that's why it's so hard to reproduce in laboratories.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because, that's the thing that people say about in these experiments, that coin flips or cards or whatever, that there's a drop off very quickly because it's boring. The thing has to, that's why they used to show the remote viewers what they remote viewed later, so they could close that loop and have it be relevant to them. Because as Dean Radin said, I think to me, one of the interviews I did, meaning is a dimension. Importance to the person involved in the experiment, relevance has a very strong effect on the success or whatever you want to call it of the experiment, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It has to be important to that person, relevant to that person that's involved in the experiment, or you're not going to get it. You're not going to get any results, because if they don't care about it, the antenna don't go up.
And there's also the expectation of results and the pressure to produce results. That's another huge damning factor in trying to study this in a lab thing.
Right.
You know, it's like, you almost need to study without the subject knowing it's being studied. And then at that point, if the phenomena shows up, great. If it doesn't, then, chances are you've been hoodwinked yet again. Mm-hmm. And the fox jumps back into the woods. it's just there's the cultural contamination of what does a subject think they're supposed to produce versus what actually happens, if anything. God, there's so many variables. It'd be so hard to really have a completely sterile environment where you could have something like this happen. And I just don't see it. I don't see it.
What? So early on, I was one of the things that they tried to show me was the idea of like mixing things up, being more anti-structural than I already was. And I didn't quite get it until I had read one of Castaneda's books. And he said something about breaking little habits. I think it was Castaneda anyway. But breaking little habits, like doing things differently, like the stuff that you do consciously or subconsciously, like say the way you brush your teeth. Brushing your teeth differently each time and thinking about these little things and kind of breaking up that sort of structure that's built into your subconscious, because you just do these things without thinking about them. It can really mess with you if you do that, because suddenly you start to think about something that you're so used to doing by rote that you're going, wait, how do I do this? It's like as if you try to think about swallowing too hard. Suddenly you're going, I can't swallow right. But I always felt like, that actually successfully opened up certain experiences. And I believe when I was talking to George Hansen, I said something about that, like how maybe you're just noticing things that you wouldn't otherwise notice because you're changing your focus on things. And he said, nope, it's just the anti-structure. It has nothing to do with what you're noticing.
Yeah. Well, first of all, can I jump back to the start of your sentence?
Sure.
I'm just going to play host for a minute. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? I'm Jeff Ritzman. My guest tonight, Soraya and Greg. Soraya, you just mentioned they told you. Who is they? Can you explain who they is?
So, no, I can't. That's
okay.
Whatever I have dealt with throughout my life has communicated with me in various ways, and especially in dream states, has given me lots of information.
Mm.
And it's a very different type of dream state. Like, it has dream imagery, but I've learned to tell what's not, like, what's information. Like, I can actually write down at this point when I have one of these, quote, dreams and say, okay, this piece is important, this piece is important, this piece is important. And invariably, in a short period of time, those pieces all line up. And I go, okay, that's what they were trying to show me.
So they told you essentially to break up routine?
Right, but I didn't understand what they were trying to show me early on. Like, it took a while before I started to understand how it was being communicated to me.
Okay.
And I think, like I said, I think it was Castaneda. If it's not Castaneda, it was reading Brian Bates' Way of Weird, which is a fictional story, but it was based on some of Castaneda's stuff as well as other shamanistic works. Mm-hmm. One of those set it off, and I went, oh, now I understand.
And see that to me, that notion feels external.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Because, it's telling you what to do to allow for more. And so,
yes.
At least in my experience with this stuff, I've had something kind of similar, which is that, there's been this demand on the part of the them, look at us, you see us, look at us. And it's a demand. It's not something that you have a necessary choice over. It's not like, okay, well, I might. No, you won't might. You look at me. You look at me right now. Do you see me? You see me standing here, you know, this desperate, not pleading, but like Harley Quinn with the baseball bat, you know? you will acknowledge me as real. You see me, I'm real. You get it? It's that kind of demand to be acknowledged as real. Because by doing that, again, it kind of forces one to ask these pondering questions, you know? And my old research partner, Lee Townsend, used to say, ponderous, man, ponderous. You know, and that's, to me, that's like, that in itself has some kind of, I don't know, it's like bait and a hook. You know, the more you ponder, the more you turn these questions over in your head. Was it real? It was really there. I really saw it. It was standing there telling me to look at it. What was that about? These things are all very confusing until you kind of put two and two together and go, like you did with the book. You said, oh, there it is. I understand what it's going after. But now, like, to me, I see the acknowledgement of it being real, you know, look at us, you know, asking me questions like, are you sure? Like, in that tone, you know, like, are you sure? Not that kind of questioning tone. You know, it's like when you would kind of state something like, I don't think you're really here. You'd get back, like, after this long, uneasy pause, you would hear, are you sure? You know, like that kind of sardonic, almost borderline nasty thing that would make you think, this is something else. This is not me. I'm not dreaming this. You know, it demands this acknowledgement. And that facilitates that same kind of pondering, obsessive change of routine, throw into anti-structure more. And so that to me says external, because whatever this is, it depends on us to get here. That I believe. I don't know that. I believe that.
I would agree with that.
You know, like without us, it can't get here. The question is, what's it want with here?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's another, like, what are you asking me that for?
Yeah. Well, see, that this makes wonderful sense to people that have had this happen to them. If you haven't had it happen to you, that's different.
The babble of mad people.
Yeah. Well, you, if you don't want to engage with the subject, yeah, it's the babble of mad people.
Yeah.
But if you do want to engage with and find out what the hell's going on, you have to at least suspend your disbelief for a while, listen to these people like you guys and figure out, you know, what can I get out of this before I know or whatever. I've had that direct experience, which is why I think the direct experience is a very important goal to get people on. Like, there's no way I can tell you this. It just has to happen to you. And it's not going to be in the way that it happened to me, but we can look at each other and nod, even though we didn't have the same thing happen to us. And if that's the case, and you can keep a detachment from it, an emotional detachment, which is really hard, it seems like, then maybe things can move ahead where you control, you know, you control the vertical and the horizontal. You control how you feel about it, what's going to happen, and how you can look at it even clinically, run it, even when it's right in your face, or at least as clinically as possible.
Yeah.
I think some of the understanding lies in that direction.
Sarai, I think that, by the way, I think that's brilliant. I think it's brilliant that you shared that comment. I think that is absolutely brilliant. And
yes, bravo for taking over the show.
Yeah.
Jeff, for 5 minutes. I'm not kidding. I'm joking and I'm serious.
That was like it, man. Like when you say things like that, that to me kind of says, okay, you know, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I feel like there's some kind of productivity path ahead of that. How do we move forward with that? I have no idea at all. But it's really cool to find that kind of like completely validated, you know, clean statement coming from something that kind of like it overlaps on so many different places and so many different other stories. It's just, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I'm so happy. Yeah.
Well, tell people where they can find you. Let's, Greg, you go first.
Best is RadioMisterioso.com, RadioMisterioso, as in Spanish, Misterioso. All the shows are there, and that's about it right now. And you can order my book and other things through that.
All right. And Jeff?
I am at Numinous Den, which is the blog. That's NUMINOUSDEN .blogspot.com.
Everybody go there right now.
I think. if you look up Numinous Den on Facebook, you'll find the page. Like the page, and I pretty much post everything that's on the blog on there. And so we can go back and forth there or at the blog, you can comment. And I also have Paratopia Oculus, which is getting ready to put out a new episode, which has been, I don't know, some months in the production of, probably 8 months ago. We haven't done anything, so it's been a while. And that's getting ready to pop. That's at ParatopiaOculus.com.
All right. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. Sir. Thanks for having us on. I love having these kind of conversations. It's where things should be going. So thanks.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. As I said, there is a Patreon only segment. It goes about a half an hour after this. Ties in a little bit with this, but we talk more about our own personal experiences that have happened recently. Yeah. So go check that out. It's only $3 to become a patron. And we will be doing some patron-only shows that are answering questions from patrons. So if you are a patron and you haven't done so already, throw us some questions, and those shows will be coming soon, kind of an Ask Us Anything sort of thing. All right, to take you out, this is a song from the Beautiful Kings. They're based out of Pittsburgh. I believe it's just one guy, and you can find him on SoundCloud. At soundcloud.com/beautifulkings. And appropriately enough, this is a song called Psychonaut. See you next time.